looked back at the body. Yeah, sure. You going to put him in the back? Yeah. I brought some Visqueen to wrap him in. Then we'll load him up, and I'll take him home. I grabbed the plastic out of the back seat and walked back to where he was lying. Little Bit got out of the truck and walked back. She stood there watching as we laid out the plastic. Mark and I picked him up and set on the sheet of plastic film, and Little Bit came over and looked down at him. Looks like he's sleeping, she said. He is, forever, I replied. Mark gave me a look, asking why she was there. I told him, she'll see it sooner or later. Little Bit was looking at the blood. There was a lot on the ground where we moved him from, and his shirt and coat were soaked.
Is that where the bullets hit him?
Yeah. Remember those bullets you had in your hand earlier? This is what they do. She looked thoughtful for a moment.
How do they do it? Do they explode?
That took me by surprise, and I tried to think of how to explain it to her. No, they don't explode, but the bullet is going very fast, and it's really hard. It just sort of cuts a hole.
I have some Band-Aids.
She opened her little first aid kit. No, sweetheart. A Band-Aid won't fix it. She looked up at me and said,
Daddy, I'm going to go wait in the truck.
She turned and walked around to the passenger side of the truck. Mark asked, Why in the hell did you bring her with you? Look, man, she's probably going to see more of it, the way things are going. She asked if she could come. I told her what I was doing, and she still wanted to, so I brought her. I don't want my kids to see anything like this. He was looking at her through the rear window. I don't really want mine to either, but this is the world we live in now. Let's load him up. I dropped the rear gate, and we loaded Lance into the back. Mark asked, Can you come help bury these guys later? I looked at the body in the road, then back down our road at the others. I'm not going to bury him. I'll drag him off into the woods if you want, but I'm not spending hours digging holes for him. Mark turned with a disgusted look on his face. We have to bury him. We can't just leave him here. No, we can't just leave him here, but I ain't burying them. I say we just drag him into the field across the road and leave him there. The buzzards will make short work of him. You are one sick bastard, you know that? What the fuck do you want from me? They just tried to shoot their way in here, and they killed Lance and Robbie. Fuck 'em. I don't give a shit about 'em. I already have a grave to dig today. I turned and climbed into the truck, started it up, and was about to pull off when Mark came up to the window. I put it down and looked at him. He said, I almost forgot. The doc says Howard is ready to come home. Can you go pick him up later? Yeah, after I do this, I'll go get him. I put the truck in gear and then put it back in park. I said, Look, Mark, you have to decide who I am. Am I some sick bastard, or am I the guy who's going to pick up Howard? The guy who brought food to Miss Janice. The guy who came running when the shooting started. The guy who volunteered to tell Lance's wife that he's dead? Here's a thought. Why don't you get some of those people who want my food, the same people who weren't here to defend the barricade, and put them on grave detail? Then maybe they'd appreciate what the rest of us are doing for them. Mark looked at the ground, and then back at me. He said, Yeah, maybe. I put the truck in gear again and pulled out. I looked over at Little Bit. She was looking out the window and being quiet, very unnatural for her. You okay, kiddo? She turned and gave me a weak smile, then looked at my carbine lying on the seat between us. Yeah, Daddy. Is that going to happen to you? Is a bullet going to cut a hole in you? I reached out and took her little hand in mine. Well, monkey, I sure hope not. But there's bad people out there, and we have to try and protect ourselves. If bad people come, then we have to try and stop them. Her little face contorted, and she started to cry. I don't want you to get shot with a bullet. Can't we just run away? Why do bad people have to come? Can't you just stay home with me and Mommy? She was crying hard, and I felt horrible. I stopped the truck, and she climbed over into my lap. I hugged her hard, and she wrapped her arms around my neck and squeezed with all her might. I'm going to be okay.
You don't think I walked all the way home just so someone could shoot me when I got here, do you? She sat up and looked at me. No, but I'm worried. I'm scared that someone will try and shoot you. Don't you worry about that. I'll be okay. No one is going to shoot me. She didn't know I had already been shot once, and I was damn glad of it. I asked if she wanted to drive. Just as quickly as the tears had started, they stopped. She sat in my lap and steered the truck. As we approached the gate to our house, she asked why we were going home and not to the man's house. I told her I wanted her to stay home and not go there with me. She started to protest, but I told her that it would be sad, and she had already seen enough sad things for the day, and she didn't say anything after that. Little Bit hopped out of the truck. I told her to tell Mommy I would be back soon and waited for her to go in the house. She stopped in the door of the house and gave me a little wave. I drove to Lance's house, which was off a little spur road from the main road, into our little neighborhood. As I pulled into the driveway, I suddenly realized I didn't know his wife's name. I honked the horn and saw a young woman look out the window. I stepped out of the truck and waved to her. The door opened, and she looked around the side of it.
Can I help you?
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. I don't know your name, but does Lance live here?
Yes, but he isn't here right now.
I know. I'm Morgan. I live on the main road.
I know who you are.
She stayed behind the door. I'm sorry, I don't know your name. I was trying to figure out how to do this, but there was no easy way to do it.
I'm Tina. What do you want?
Tina, can you come outside so I can talk to you?
We can talk right here. Don't come toward me.
I had no doubt that she had a gun behind the door. I said, I don't know exactly how to say this, but Lance was killed earlier. She didn't say anything. She just stood there staring at me. He was shot by a group of people who were trying to get in to steal food. She still hadn't moved.
Tina, did you hear me?
You're lying, she said flatly. I wish to God I was. I'm so sorry to have to tell you. I have his body in the back of the truck. I thought he should be brought here to you. She told me I was wrong and called me a liar again. I tried to get her to come out so I could show her, but she refused, and eventually she told me to go away, and she shut the door. I didn't know what to do. I had envisioned crying and wailing, maybe, but not a flat refusal to accept it. Finally, I did the only thing I could. I carried Lance up to the front of the house and laid him out, then pulled the plastic off so she could see him. I could see her in the window, but when I bent over to set him down and straighten back up, she was gone. I sat in the truck for a few minutes, waiting to see if she would come out, but I never saw so much as the curtain move. After about half an hour, I started up the old Chevy, backed out of the drive, and headed down the road. I turned left toward Danny's house and drove down. Danny met me on the porch with a, yo.
You get the boy to Reggie's? I asked.
Yeah, he's pretty tore up. I gotta go tell his sister that her son is dead now, too.
Damn. First the girl and now him. I can't even imagine it. I asked him if he would come and help me bury Lance. I told him how Tina had reacted, and he just shook his head. He suggested we go get Mark and have him go with us, being as he was the one that everyone looked to. I agreed it was a good idea, and Danny went over to the shed and grabbed a couple of shovels. Mark was still at the barricade, talking to a couple of the guys from the block, and we motioned for him to come over. He agreed to help and went back to the barricade. He asked one of the guys there to stay at the barricade and back up Rick, handing the man his carbine. Mark returned and climbed in, and we went back to Lance's house. His body was still lying in the yard and looked just as I had left it. Danny and I stayed in the truck, and Mark went to the house. He knocked on the door a couple of times, and there was no response. He called out several times, still nothing. He tried the door, but it was locked. He waved for us to come up, and we met him at the door, not sure what to do.
What do you think?
Danny asked. I don't like it.
She has to be in there, and now I'm concerned for her safety. We need to talk to her, Mark said. I'll go around back and see if I can see anything. You want to stay here in case she comes to the door? I said. Yeah, I'll wait here. Danny, you go around the right side, check the windows and doors, see if anything's unlocked. We both gave a nod and headed around either side of the house. I was checking the last window on my side when I heard Danny call me. I walked around to the back of the house. He was standing on the back porch, and the sliding glass door was open. Pointing to the open door, I asked, "You open it?" He shook his head. He had his carbine at low ready, directed at the door. "Let's go see," I said. He nodded and stepped through the door. The kitchen was empty. It was small and very neat and clean. We stepped into the living room, and it was empty too. I called out, "Tina, you okay?" From outside, Mark called to us. "You guys inside?" "Yeah. We're in the living room. We're going to check the rest of the house," Danny called back. There was a hallway to our right. Danny took the lead and lit the hallway with the light on his carbine. The first door opened onto the bathroom, and it was empty. Across the hall from that door was another. Danny stepped in front of it. I reached out and grabbed the knob. Looking at him, I gave a nod. He nodded back, and I threw the door open. Danny stepped in quickly and checked the room. It was empty. Again, I called out, "Tina, you in here?" We checked two more rooms, but she wasn't in them. I threw the last door open, and Danny stepped in, with me following him. Tina was lying on the bed, in a fetal position, on her left side, facing the door. She was clutching a picture frame in her left arm, and a Ruger .357 revolver was on the floor beside the bed, her right hand hanging off the edge. We stepped up to the side of the bed and looked down. The surefire on Danny's rifle revealed an entry in her temple. The skin was burned and puckered. She must have had the pistol pressed against her head when she pulled the trigger. I told Danny I was going to get Mark and left the room. Opening the front door, Mark could tell from the look on my face what we had found. "Where is she?" he said. Stepping into the room, Mark was visibly shaken. "Damn it!" We looked around the house for a note and didn't find one. I didn't know Lance real well, and I didn't know Tina at all, but I could only imagine that her grief over Lance was what brought her to do this. We wrapped Tina in the bed linens and carried her out the sliding glass door and out to the backyard. Setting her down, we went around to the front and carried Lance around. The three of us stood there, around the bodies, not saying anything, just looking down at the two wrapped bundles. Finally, Mark spoke up. "Can you guys handle this?" Danny and I just nodded, and Mark said, "I'm going to search the house for anything the community can use. Whatever I find, I'll put in the back of your truck. Can you drop it off at my place when you're done?" "Yeah, man. You need a ride back?" I asked. "No, I'll walk." Mark headed back to the house, while Danny went back to the Suburban and returned with the shovels. We picked a spot out near what had been a small flower garden. We walked off a plot big enough for each grave, and then I took off my vest and leaned my carbine against a fence post. Danny did likewise, and we began to dig. It took about 3 hours to dig the two graves. When we had them about 5 feet deep, we put the bodies in. Once they were in, we stood there looking down at them. I'm not a religious man, and neither is Danny. I couldn't begin to know what to say, and after a brief silence, we began to fill the graves. Once the dirt was mounded up, Danny and I collected our gear and went back to the truck. We threw the shovels in beside two boxes Mark must have put there. The whole time we were digging the graves and lowering the bodies, Danny and I never talked, and even in the truck, we were silent as we drove back to Danny's house. Pulling up at the gate, I stopped, and Danny hopped out. After shutting the door, he looked in. "I'll see you later, man." "Yeah, later, man." Thad picked Marty up and set his chair upright. The man was still crying and whining, asking what Thad was going to do to him. Thad walked out of the barn, returned with another chair and set it down in front of Marty. Marty looked around, not sure what was about to happen. Thad spun the chair around so the back was facing Marty, swung a leg over, and sat down, resting his arms on the top of the chair's back. Thad sat for a full minute without saying a word. Marty's eyes shifted from side to side nervously, and he licked his lips in apprehension. Thad sat there with his forehead resting on his forearms, looking down between the slats of the chair back. Finally, Thad looked at Marty with an expressionless face. This just served to unnerve Marty even further, and his chest started to heave as he sucked air and blew it out through clenched teeth. Finally, Marty couldn't take it anymore.
"What do you want?"
he asked, crying as he did. Thad sat there for a moment. "You got a family?" Marty answered immediately.
"Yes, yes, I have a wife and a son. He's 12.
Thad cocked his head to the side. "You love him?"
"Of course, more than anything."
Thad pursed his lips and nodded his head before dropping it again to look at the slats.
"Me too. I love my wife and boy too," he said as he looked back up.
Marty's newfound hope quickly faded, his face yielding to the contortions once again.
"Look, man, I'm really sorry. It wasn't my idea. Chuck did it."
"You lit the fire, didn't you?"
Marty's eyes grew wide once again. His lips trembled, mouthing words that never sounded. Finally, a weak,
"Yes," issued from his lips.
"Why? You say Anita shot at you. So you two shot her and set the house on fire where they're still alive? Why not just let them be and leave?"
"You don't understand these people. They tell you to do something, you do it, that's it. There's no discussion. Burning the house is standard procedure for them. People don't do what they're told. They teach him a lesson."
"So then, you're only doing this because they make you, huh?"
"Yeah. Yeah, this kind of thing isn't me. I only do this because I want to take care of my family."
"You know, I walked a long, long way to get home to my family. I did a lot of crazy shit to get home. The only thing that kept me going was the thought of them, and you set them on fire."
"Look, I'm really, really sorry. I didn't want any of this,"
Marty managed through the renewed tears. Thad sat looking at the man.
"You want a cigarette?"
Marty wasn't sure how to respond. He wasn't sure if it was a genuine offer or it opened this whole thing up to a new level of hell.
Yeah, sure.
Thad pointed to his breast pocket.
"In there, right?"
Marty looked down at the blue postal service coat he was wearing and nodded. Thad leaned over, fished the smokes and lighter out of his pocket, and tapped one out, holding it up so Marty could grab it with his teeth. Thad struck the old trench-style lighter and held the flame up so Marty could get to it. Marty took a long, hard drag on the cigarette, then thanked Thad. Thad nodded his head and held the lighter up between himself and Marty, looking at it. Marty was sucking the cigarette down hard and fast, looking at the lighter Thad was turning between his fingers. Reaching the filter, Marty spit the butt out, making sure to turn his head so it didn't look like he was spitting it at the big man. Thad looked up and shook another one out, holding it up in a manner that asked if he wanted another. Marty nodded, and Thad leaned over so he could get to it and lit it for him. Again, Marty inhaled deeply, letting out a cloud of smoke. Thad held the lighter up once again.
"This is the lighter you used to light the fire?"
Thad was looking past the lighter at Marty. Marty moved the cigarette from side to side in his mouth nervously. He took another long pull on the smoke, squinting his left eye as he did. Without saying anything, he slowly nodded his head. Thad was still holding the lighter with two fingers between the two of them. In one quick motion, he snapped his fist around the lighter. The quick movement startled Marty, causing him to spit the butt out. It landed in his lap, causing him to gyrate in the chair.
"Hey! Hey!"
Thad stood up. Marty was still looking into his lap at the glowing butt resting on his crotch. Thad paid no attention to him and walked over to a corner of the barn. Marty finally got the butt out of his lap and noticed the big man was gone. He craned his neck around, looking for him.
Hey! Where'd you go? Hey, man, where are you?
Thad walked out where Marty could see him. He had a pack over his shoulder.
What are you doing?
Marty asked. I'm gonna leave you now.
What?
I'm going.
You're just gonna leave me here?
Yeah, you're on your own.
Thank you,
Marty said. Don't thank me. I said, you're on your own, Thad replied. He then struck the lighter and tossed it into a corner of the barn onto a pile of hay that he had soaked in kerosene. The hay caught immediately, the flame growing with rapid intensity. Marty said,
You're leaving me here.
Then he said it again, as a terrified, screamed question.
You're leaving me here?
He began to thrash his upper body back and forth, like a child restrained in a high chair might. It was the only part of his body he could freely move, and he was doing everything he could to move it. Thad stood there for a moment, looking at Marty, as he started to scream and shriek. Marty the postman called for help. He begged Thad to release him, and then he cursed him, using every vile epithet he could imagine to impugn Thad's race, manhood, and heritage. When none of that drew a response from the big man, Marty screamed out,
That bitch screamed her lungs out! She begged for her life, and we burned her ass!
Thad stood there motionless. You've already begged for your life. Guess that just leaves the screaming and burning. Marty's face was expressionless. His mouth hung open with drool running from the corner onto the postal service patch on his coat, but only for a moment. He went into another fit of fighting against the ropes, thrashing back and forth violently, succeeding once again in tipping the chair onto its side. Thad walked out of the barn and over to the scout. He set the pack on the hood, leaned against the fender, and watched as the flames grew up the side of the barn where he'd set the fire. Through the open door, he could see the man lying on the ground, squirming to try and free himself. He could hear the man screaming and cussing. By the time the roof of the barn caught and began to burn, the heat was enough to make Thad back the scout up. He then got out and leaned against the fender once again. Inside, the heat must be unbearable. Thad had never heard anyone scream that loud. The pigs in the pen were also screaming, more from fright than the heat, as they were far enough away to be safe. In one loud crack, the beam supporting the roof finally gave and fell in, silencing the man. The only sound in the air now was that of the fire and terrified swine. Thad sat there for a moment, looking at the tall flames, the sparks climbing up into the pitch-black, cloudless sky above. He stood there with his face raised to the heavens and said, I'm sorry. Walking over to the pig pen, he opened the gate and went in. Thad drew the big blade and slashed the rope holding the body. It fell into the swirling mass of hogs at his feet. The light from the fire played off the rumps of those closest to it and lit the faces of those opposite. Thad looked down at the ghoulish, blood-stained grin of one of them, and it almost looked as though it were saying thank you. Thad left the pen, leaving the gate open, and went back to the scout. He climbed in and sat behind the wheel, looking at what laid before him. It was a familiar scene, with the only difference being there was no innocence under these flames. Chapter 21 Sarge turned the map around a couple of times till he had it oriented. He stuck his index finger out and ran it over the map, and finding what he was looking for, he tapped the map with the finger. He told Ted to turn left when he hit the dirt road. Ted nodded and hung a hard left onto the white sand road, fishtailing the truck as he did. Dallas was an old shack 8.5 miles due north of the Sarge's shack. It was in a huge underdeveloped area crisscrossed with roads, paths, and trails. Mike and Doc sat in the back of the truck, trying to hang on as the truck careened around the corners.
What in the hell is he trying to do? Turn the damn thing over? Doc said to Mike.
He was leaning against the tailgate with his right arm hooked over the top of it. Mike was sitting on top of the stack of camo nets close to the cab. His right leg stuck out against the far side of the bed to brace himself. He shook his head. He had a big smile on his face, as much as he could smile with the wound. He looked like a kid who was enjoying the ride. The trip to the little shack didn't take long. When they got close, Sarge called a stop, and Ted pulled over to the side of the road. They got out and huddled around the map. "I was worried they saw you," Mike said. "I was scared shitless." Doc was stretching his back. "They would have, but I climbed out and hid in the woods. They saw the boat, and that had their interest. I didn't know what to do, and then you guys opened up, and all hell broke loose." Mike asked, "Were there coasties in that RIB? "All I saw were DHS guys. There may have been one operating it, but none on the deck." Mike shook his head. "Man, I hope not. My old man was in the Coast Guard." "He fired that rocket?" "Yeah. Hell of a shot," Doc said. Sarge stepped between them. "Story time's over. Mike, you and Doc, head through the bush here. Take a due east heading. You're looking for a little shack over there. Make sure there aren't any surprises waiting for us. If you make contact, turn due south, and we'll pick you up in the first dirt road you come to." "Anything to get out of that damn rattle trap," Doc said. And then the two of them headed into the bush. Sarge went to the passenger side. "Saddle up, Tonto. We gotta be ready if they need us," he said over the bed. "What do you mean, we, white man?" Ted said. Sarge chuckled, and they climbed in and waited. Mike and Doc were both wearing NVGs and communicated with hand signals as they worked their way through the bush. They were approaching the shack from the east side, and when it came into sight, they took a knee and waited, watching the shack for any movement. Anything that indicated someone was there. They waited for 20 minutes without moving or saying anything. Finally, Mike looked over at Doc, raised his index finger and twirled it, then pointed to the south. Doc nodded, and the two men stood up and moved out. The shack sat in a small clearing, maybe half an acre. The two moved silently around the eastern edge of it, and coming to the southern edge, they stopped and took a knee to look and listen. They continued this process around the western and northern borders. Satisfied it was clear, the two men went across the road that passed just to the north and checked it as well. The two men moved back to the clearing, skirting the western edge, and approached the small shack from that side. At the edge of the shack, they paused again, listening. Mike was paying particular attention to the ground around the shack. Doc motioned, and Mike followed him to the northern edge of the shed. They carefully checked that side, then moved to the eastern side, where the door was located. There were no windows in the shack, no way to look inside. Mike stepped around Doc at the door and checked very carefully around its four sides. Finding nothing, the two of them prepared to open it. Mike positioned himself in front of the door with his carbine shouldered and at low ready. When he triggered the green laser on his weapon, Doc jerked the door open. Mike stepped inside quickly, turning to the left, and Doc immediately followed him in and turned to the right. The shack was big, 30 by 40 feet, a big set of double doors in the south side. It looked like it had been used to store equipment, but not recently. Mike found some old oil filters, big ones, piled in a corner. But otherwise, the place was empty, save for black widows and a population of antlions that must have numbered in the thousands. Mike told Doc to hang out while he went back and got the old man. Mike went back through the woods to the truck. As he approached, he gave a little whistle. It was answered with another, and he came out of the bush and walked up to Sarge's side of the truck. "Well?" Sarge asked as he came up. "It's clear, boss. Big place, too. We can park the truck in it. Well, let's go see this palace." Mike jumped into the back of the truck again, and Ted drove off toward the shack. As they pulled in, Doc came out to meet them. The four men went into the tin-clad shack to look it over. Just as Mike had said, the structure was big enough to drive the truck into, and they agreed that for the night, they would drive in. The next day, they would again make a hide for it in the woods. Sarge didn't like the idea of having the truck in there with them, in case they were discovered. In the meantime, they decided to set up camp for the night. As they went back out to the truck, a low whump drifted across the forest.
"Looks like they found the party favors," Mike said.
Ted just shrugged his shoulders and went to the truck to get his pack. Mike hopped into the truck and drove it around to the south side, where Doc was opening the doors. Mike backed the truck until it was against the far side of the building before shutting it down. This way, it gave them some room to get some speed if they needed to get the hell out of Dodge. The rest of the evening was spent setting up camp for the night and preparing the comm gear. While they wouldn't transmit tonight, Sarge wanted it ready for the morning. Mike volunteered to stand the first watch and went outside and moved off into the tree line. Inside, the rest of the guys sorted out their gear and broke out some MREs. Sarge dug around in the bed of the truck, looking for his stove. He was out of coffee and getting damn irritable. Ted came over and liberated it from under the camo nets and handed it over.
"Here, before you go completely insane."
Sarge grabbed the stove and set it on the tailgate.
"Believe me, you don't want to see me without coffee."
Ted leaned on the top of the bed.
"You know that day's coming, right?"
Sarge was busy priming the stove and didn't look up.
"What day?"
"The day when there's no more coffee."
Sarge stopped in mid-stroke, his thumb still over the end of the plunger in the tank of the stove. He looked over at Ted with his teeth gritted.
"You watch your mouth! Don't start no shit! There won't be no shit!"
Ted laughed and turned away.
"I'm just saying."
I had to go to Mark's house after leaving Danny's. It was on the way anyway, so I stopped and dropped off the boxes. When I set them out at the little shed in his front yard, I opened them to take a look. There were 2 cans of beans and half a bag of flour and some hygiene products. In the second box, there was a can of salt and a box of pepper. Seeing how little the guy had struck me. If these 2 boxes were any indication of how the others around there were doing, then people were about to get damn desperate. I admired Lance for never having said a word about how thin things were at home, but I knew most people weren't as stoic. Mark was still at the barricade when I pulled up on my way to get Howard. I told him I had left the boxes in front of his shed. He gave me a look and then said,
"Thanks. I'll have to get Marie over to open her lock."
He shook his head and said, "Putting 2 locks on there was a good idea at the time, but she's a real pain in the ass."
"What do you have left in there?"
"Not much. We're down to the mush that was in those humanitarian aid boxes. I guess it'll keep you alive, but it tastes like shit."
"What is it?"
I asked, and suppressed a smile. He thought for a minute.
"Kind of like plain oatmeal and cream of wheat. It's hard to explain. The package has all the nutritional info on it, and it's got everything in it, except for taste."
I couldn't hide my grin anymore. Mark noticed it and said,
"What?"
"I was just thinking of all those commercials we used to see on TV that had those kids with bloated bellies eating slop from a bowl with flies buzzing around it."
"And you find that funny?"
He kind of glared at me, like I was crazy for saying that.
No, it's just that it reminded me of the South Park episode where they made fun of Sally Struthers. Remember how she used to always be on those commercials?"
Slowly a big smile spread across his face.
"What was that character's name? The little Ethiopian kid that they brought over?"
I started to laugh, and so did he. "I don't remember his name. I just remember him chasing shit down trying to get some food, and her fat ass eating everything that wasn't nailed down."
Rick looked over. "What's so damn funny?"
Mark looked at him, with tears in his eyes.
"South Park."
"South Park?" Rick asked.
"Never mind," Mark said with a wave, still laughing.
We both recovered and talked for a minute about some things in the neighborhood, Miss Janice for one, and how we needed to check on her. He asked me about the raiders that were still lying in the road, if I was serious about not helping to bury them. I assured him I was, but that I would still help haul them off into the woods or the field across the road and dump them. The look on his face made it pretty clear that he wasn't happy with my position. He said,
"I'll let you know when you get back."
I drove out the barricade and headed down to the Doc's place. Parking in front of the office, I walked around back to the house. It was connected, but the Doc was usually in the house and not the office. I knocked on the door, and a woman opened it. I introduced myself and told her I was there to pick up Howard. She introduced herself as Nancy Peters, the Doc's wife, and invited me in. She told me Howard was doing well and was more than ready to go home. I gave a little laugh, and I said I was sure he was. She led me out to the Florida room, where Howard was sitting in a wicker chair with his good leg up on a stool. "Hey, old man, you ready to go?" I asked as I came in. He looked up and said, "More than ready. What took so damn long?" "If you were in a hurry, you could have called a cab." Howard laughed as the Doc walked in. "Is this your ride?" "Yeah, his chariot is outside," I replied. "Nancy, can you gather up Howard's stuff while I go over some things with..." The Doc paused and looked at me. "Sorry, I don't know your name." "Oh, I'm Morgan," I said, and stuck out my hand. He took it, and we shook. "Follow me, Morgan. I need to go over Howard's aftercare." We went out to his office, where he pulled a few items from a cabinet and put them in a box. There were rolls of gauze, gauze pads, and a bottle of antibiotics, and some painkillers. He gave me a concerned look. "Howard doesn't like the painkillers, but take them with you. He may need them. Make sure he takes his antibiotics 3 times a day. How about the wound? Does it still need cleaned, or is it closed up?" "The staples are still in, and yes, it needs cleaned and the dressing changed once a day. I'm putting a bottle of betadine in the box, too. You have any saline? I like to mix the two for wound irrigation." He looked up at me, a little surprised. "Yeah," he said, and he took a quart bottle from a shelf and dropped it in the box, along with a big irrigation syringe. "You have training?" "Just OJT. "Well, if you need anything, just let me know. If he develops a fever or anything, bring him in." We went back to the Florida room, where Howard was still sitting. There wasn't a wheelchair for him, so he had to use a pair of crutches to get out of the truck. I helped Howard in and put his crutches in the back, along with the box Doc packed for us. Doc and Nancy were standing in the driveway, waving as we pulled out. The ride back to our road was short, less than a mile, and Howard sat quietly as we drove. When we passed a family walking down the side of the road, pushing a shopping cart, he finally spoke up. "We're fucked, aren't we?" I looked at the family in the rearview mirror. They had moved to the side of the road when we passed them. "Things sure are different now." He stared out the window in silence for a moment. "Just think of all the lost knowledge, things that everyone used to know how to do, that now no one knows anymore. It's all still out there, in books. We'll just have to learn it all again." I looked over at him and smiled. He was still looking out the window. "What good is an old one-legged man going to be? I can't even collect firewood to heat my home or shoot limb rats for food." "You can still shoot limb rats. Phyllis will just have to go get them for you. As for firewood, I'll keep you stocked. And there is one thing you can do that is very important." Howard looked over at me, trying not to look too interested in what I had to say. "You have your ham rig, right? You need to spend your time listening and making notes. We need to know what is out there and what is coming our way. You can do that, can't you?" "I guess even with one leg I can do that. I know it doesn't look too good today, but think about the future. You can still stand guard at the barricade, can't you? If you're going to do that, it means some of the younger guys will be freed up to plant when spring comes, stuff like that. Hell, at some point, we're going to need a school and a teacher. Maybe you'll do that. Point is, we don't know everything we're going to need, but we know that we're going to need everyone. You hear me?" He looked over and nodded. "I hear you." I smiled, and he smiled back at me and asked me to stop at the barricade. Mark came up to the truck when I stopped. He said, "How you feeling, Howard?" "I'm pretty good for someone who lost half a leg. I wanted to say thank you to you and Morgan. You guys saved my life." "Shoot, all I did was drive you down to the old Sawbones." Mark pointed at me and said, "He's the one who really saved your hide." "It was just some first aid. I couldn't let you lie there and bleed out."
Well, it saved my ass, Howard said. Rick called out. There's a motorcycle coming. I stepped out of the Suburban, put the sling of my carbine over my head, and walked out to the road. The scooter was coming out of Altoona and was loud as hell. I've always heard bikers say that loud pipes save lives, but damn. The bike slowed as it got closer and coasted to a stop in the road in front of the barricade. The man sitting on it was wearing a pair of clean jeans and a leather jacket. His boots looked like high-techs or something like them. There was a rough-looking scabbard strapped to the right side of the bike, with a rifle butt jutting out of it. He sat on the bike for a moment, then put the kickstand down and stepped off. He was wearing a helmet, one of the little skullcap kind, and took it off. You guys have any clean water? He called out. I was standing in front of the barricade with my carbine at low ready. He wasn't holding a firearm and was standing there with his hands on his hips. After a moment, I told him we did and waved him over to the barricade, and the keg kept behind it. He opened one of the hard boxes in the side of the bike and pulled out a couple of 1-liter water bottles. When he was about halfway to the barricade, I asked him if he had any other weapons on him. He said that he did, and opened his jacket to show a Glock and a high-ride holster on his belt. Is that the only one? I asked him. He smiled and replied, No, there's another one on the bike, too. Just keep it in the holster, and we'll be fine, I replied. He held his hands up and mocked surrender. No problem, man. All I want is some water. Besides, from the looks of you guys, I don't have enough guns. He went over to the keg and filled his bottles. Mark came up to me as he was filling them and said he didn't like the look of him. I told him his cop was sticking out, and he laughed when he looked down at his zipper. That got me a hearty, fuck you. As Biker Dude was screwing the cap on the second bottle, I walked over to him and asked him where he was coming from. He told me he had been down in Miami, but he was from Phoenix. He had come down to pick up the bike he was riding, bought online from an old Cuban dude, and had come down with his truck and a trailer to pick it up when things went to shit, as he put it. How's Miami? I asked. He just laughed. Worse than ever. If you can imagine, Liberty City was on fire when I pulled out. Alpha 66 was trying to put together a navy so they could invade Cuba, and the Cubans and Haitians were in the business of wholesale murder of one another. He said to hang on, then went to his bike and came back with a black case. When he opened it, I suddenly thought I was dealing with someone a few sandwiches short of a picnic. He pulled an iPad out of the case. I kind of raised my eyebrows at him, and he just smiled and hit the power button. To my complete astonishment, the damn thing came on. He winked and said, Check this out. He played a video taken with the iPad. It was the skyline of Miami, and it was burning. The view panned down, and there were bodies on the ground. The vantage point appeared to be from across a large canal and from at least the second floor of a building. I watched the video in total amazement as the thick black smoke billowed into the sky, and the crackle of gunfire could be heard in the background. He explained that what we were seeing was Overtown in Miami. He had been on the roof of a building watching the chaos. Miami was a cesspool. Mounds of uncollected garbage were piled everywhere. Many of the residents of the city and suburbs of Miami came from third world countries, and when the power failed and the country started to slide backward, they naturally went back to what they knew. Sewage was simply dumped into the street along with the carcasses of animals killed for food. The latter included everything from cats and dogs to chickens and iguanas. He told me how he had watched three Haitians try to kill a donkey with a machete. The donkey had brayed and screamed when they struck it with the big blade. They had the poor creature tied to a palm tree, and it fought against the rope, but couldn't escape. He said he would never forget the look on that animal's face, how big its eyes were, wide in abject terror. At that point, it was the worst thing he had ever seen in his life. He couldn't take it, and used his Mosin. He nodded his chin at the rifle on his bike to put the animal down. He said when he shot the damn donkey, the Haitian with the machete stopped with the blade poised over his head for another strike. The man was covered in blood, from his face to feet. Hearing the shot and seeing the animal drop, they simply began to cut it up. He finished up by saying, "Hell, I'm a hunter, but that was just awful." I pointed to the iPad and asked, "How?" He smiled real big and waved me over to the bike. Opening one of the boxes, he pulled away the felt from the top to reveal a copper wire mesh. I guess the look on my face was enough of a question, so he went on to explain how he had some of his stuff in a Faraday cage he built. When he had had to downsize to fit everything on the bike, he took it apart and lined the box on the bike with it. I shook my head. He was pretty sharp. "Hey, what's your name?" He stuck his hand out and replied, "Jeff. Jeff Collins." I introduced myself to him and asked about his trip up. He walked over to the bike and I followed him as he spoke. I was curious why he was no farther from Miami than he was, since I had walked from Tallahassee in far less time. He told me he didn't have any family and wasn't in a rush to get anywhere. He was just cruising around, finding fuel where he could and getting a feel for things. He opened the box on the bike, put the iPad in, and pulled out a big bag of bazooka bubblegum, reached in, and grabbed a handful, then offered it to me. "I don't want any, but can I take some for my kids?"
"Sure, man, help yourself," he replied,
as he unwrapped a piece and stuck it in his mouth, then unfolded the little comic. I reached in, grabbed a few pieces, and stuck them in my pocket. He read the comic and laughed to himself, then proceeded to open four more pieces and stuff them in his mouth as well. I laughed when he looked up with a mouthful of the hard squares, trying to get them all mashed up. "Like bubblegum?" I asked. He swatted at a gnat that was harassing his ear and replied,
"You gotta enjoy the little things in life, especially nowadays."
"Yeah, I guess so." He swatted at the gnat again. "What the hell's with these damn flies?" he said, as he was trying to draw a bead on one in front of his face.
"Gotta love dog peter gnats."
He stopped with his fist clenched tight in front of his face, an unsuccessful attempt at capturing the pest, and looked at me with one eye half squinted.
"What'd you call him?"
With that huge wad of gum lodged in his jaw, he looked like the cartoon baseball player on the bag of Big League Chew bubblegum.
"Dog peter gnats. Where do you usually see the damn things?"
He folded at the waist and began to laugh. He said,
"That's funny as hell. I never heard that before."
"There's only one surefire way to get rid of him." He chewed the wad for a moment, then asked,
"How?"
with more than a hint of suspicion.
"Cut a hole in the seat of your pants. Buzzing around your face is only their second choice."
The gnats were buzzing around his head when it rolled back and began to laugh. I watched as one of the little bastards flew right up his left nostril, like a goldfish crumb caught in the suction of a Kirby vacuum. What happened next startled me. He stopped in mid-laugh and went to take a breath to try to snot-rocket the pest out, but the sound that came from his throat was like a half-full bathtub draining, when the little vortex of water forms and that deep-throated slurp comes up from the drain. That sound was followed immediately by the sound the little rubber stopper would make when, caught in that vortex, it found its way over the hole and plugged the flow of water. Jeff reached up and grabbed his neck. His eyes were wide and his mouth hung agape. I looked at him for a second before I realized he couldn't breathe. His face was growing progressively redder, and the veins in his neck and forehead bulged. I ran around him and tried to perform the Heimlich maneuver on him to no effect. I had my arms around his midsection, jerking upward against his sternum, trying to dislodge the wad of gum in his throat. After a couple of attempts, his knees buckled, and with all his weight on me, he slumped to the ground. He was still trying to get a breath, but it just wasn't happening. I knelt down and pounded on his back. Nothing. After another brief moment, he fell to the side. Tears were dripping from his nose as he lay there on the road. Opening his mouth and holding his tongue down with my thumb, I stuck my right index finger into the back of his throat to try and get the pink mass out. All I managed was to pull a long, sticky string out of his mouth. He was motionless by then. I tried a sternum rub to see if he would respond,
but he was gone. I heard a scuffling sound and looked up to see Howard hobbling over. He stopped at my side, looking down at the body.
"Why'd you kill him?"
I looked up at the old man. "Look here, Kickstand. You start any shit, and you're going straight to the glue factory." He just shrugged his shoulders and stood there. Mark walked over, looking confused as hell. "What in the hell just happened?" He stepped up and knelt beside Jeff and put his index and middle finger to his throat. Looking up, he said, "There's still a pulse." He stood up and straddled Jeff's motionless body, raising his right foot. Mark stomped on his chest, planting his boot right on Jeff's sternum. Jeff let out a coughing kind of sound, and that big pink wad shot straight up into the air. Reflexively, Howard stuck his hand out, and the mass landed in his hand. Jeff took in a deep breath and let out a long moan.
"Oh, my fucking ribs," he said, as he wrapped his arms around his chest and rolled onto his side. "I think my ribs are broke," he moaned.
Mark, Howard, and I stood there, looking down at him for a minute. Jeff looked up and asked who hit him. Howard pointed to Mark and replied,
"He did, except he put the boot leather to you."
Jeff rolled onto his back and looked up at Mark.
"You a cop? That's police brutality, man."
Mark smiled. "You're welcome." I reached down and pulled Jeff to his feet. He was still holding his ribs and leaning forward slightly. Howard held out the wad of gum.
"Want this back?"
Jeff looked over.
"Hell no, I don't want that shit. My throat is killing me."
Howard tossed the wad off into the palmettos at the side of the road. "You gonna be all right?" I asked.
"I need a place to sit down for a while."
I told him to come with me. He was worried about his bike, but I assured him it would be safe there. We had to push it behind the barricade before he would agree. I loaded Jeff and Howard up and headed for Howard's house. I managed to get Howard delivered to his place, but helping him into the house was a bit of a pain. He needed a ramp, and I added that to my mental list of things to do. I asked about their firewood situation, and his wife said they were fine for now. I told them both, if they needed anything, to come and get me. They were both a little hard-headed, saying they didn't need any help, and I said, "Well, if you do, you know where to find me." With Howard finally home, I took Jeff to my place. He wasn't saying much, and I couldn't blame him for it. At the house, I took him in and deposited him on the sofa. He protested at first, not wanting to burden me, but I told him not to worry about it, to take it easy for a little while, and that he could stay the night and leave in the morning. I went to see Mel in the kitchen and told her about our guest. By the time I got back to the living room, Jeff was sound asleep. I left him there and went back to the kitchen. "He's asleep," I said as I came in.
"Is he armed?"
Yeah, he has a pistol that I know of."
"And you bring him in here with our girls?" she said, leaning against the island with her arms crossed.
"Well, yeah. I don't think he's going to be a problem. He seems like a pretty good guy." I told her what had happened, and she said she wouldn't be comfortable until I had Jeff's pistol. I nudged him, and when he didn't wake, I slipped it out of the holster and showed it to Mel. "Good. Now I don't feel like I'll be killed in my sleep. Now that that's settled, why in the hell did you take her with you today to load up a dead body?" "She wanted to go. I told her what I was doing, and she wanted to go. You think we can hide this sort of thing from them forever?"
"She's 7. Of course she wanted to go with you. The only dead people she has ever seen were on TV. She doesn't understand it."
"She has a better understanding of it now. Look, I knew she wasn't ready for what she was going to see, but I would rather that first encounter be under a somewhat controlled situation than when we are running for our lives and she freezes when she sees a dead body. We're all going to be seeing more of them."
She stood there for a moment, looking right through me.
"Why are you so damn morbid? Why do you think we're going to go all Mad Max?"
I was stunned.
"Have you looked around? Do you have any idea what's going on, how bad things are?
The power's out, so what? It's like the hurricanes a couple of years ago. It's not that big a deal." That made me pause.
All this time I had been worried that Mark and the other folks weren't really getting it, and it had never occurred to me that Mel wasn't either. I said, "It's not that big a deal. Are you out of your damn mind? We're doing better than most because of what we put away. But for most folks out there, the shit has hit the fan in a big way. And let me clue you into something. We're going to be in the same boat as everyone else soon enough. The food we have stored is going to run out. The fuel is going to run out. And we'll be like everyone else, hungry and desperate." She said, "I don't think it's that bad, is it?" After we buried Lance and his wife today, Mark went through their house. They had two cans of food and a little flour. That was it. Everyone around here is probably in the same boat. Mel cocked her head. "Why did you have to bury his wife?" "She wouldn't come out. She called me a liar when I told her he was dead. So I left his body in the yard and went to get Mark. When we got back, we found her dead in the house. She shot herself." Mel stood there, silent for a moment, and then said, "Oh." Chapter 22. Thad loaded everything from the cache into the scout. When he was done, he examined the rifle he had taken off the security man. It was an M4, with an ACOG optic sight, and a light on the foregrip. He had no experience with the weapon, and started trying to figure out how it worked. He pressed the mag release, and the magazine fell out and landed on the ground. He turned the weapon over and looked at the mag well. He reinserted the mag and tapped the bottom, then shook the weapon to make sure it was in tight. He pressed the release again, this time with his hand under it, catching it. After setting the mag on the hood, he grabbed the charging handle and pulled it to the rear, and the chambered round ejected. Thad picked up the round and put it back in the magazine. Once he had it back in, he put the mag back into the weapon and pulled the charging handle back and let it go. It closed with a solid slap. Thad put the rifle to his shoulder and looked through the sight. He aimed at a live oak about 20 yards from him and squeezed the trigger. It was stiff and wouldn't move. Thad lowered the rifle and looked it over. Finding the safety, he flipped it up and once again put it against his shoulder. Pressing the switch for the light, he squeezed the trigger, and this time the weapon barked and kicked slightly against his shoulder. He settled the rifle and fired a couple more rounds at the tree. It didn't look like he had hit it, but walking up, he could see the small holes in the bark. Thad flipped the safety back to the safe position. Feeling a little more comfortable with the rifle, Thad put it back in the truck and climbed in. Leaving the farm for the last time, he drove by the burning barn and headed toward his house. Thad pulled up in front of his house and sat there looking at it. After a moment, he got out of the truck, went to the back, and took out a blue plastic jug. He let himself in and left the key in the lock. He poured the kerosene out on the floor of his bedroom and lit it. He went to Tony's room, where he did the same thing. He poured the rest of the kerosene on the sofa and lit it as well. With the flames building, he walked out on the front porch and stood there for a minute, stuffing his hands into the pockets on his coat. He rolled his shoulders against the chill in the air and took in the scene from his front porch for the last time. His hand found little Tony's toy in his coat pocket, and he clutched it, thinking about the Transformers movie he had watched with Tony, the part where the bad guys had burned the Transformers' home world and the good guys had to go on the run. Thad climbed back into the truck, started it, and sat there for a minute. He backed the truck out onto the road and paused again. After a moment, he turned the truck north on Swift Mud Road and started to drive. As he drove, Thad thought about where he was going, where he could go. He knew Sarge had left his place. Then he had a thought and stopped the truck in the road. Reaching into the back seat, he pulled his pack to the front. He dug around in the pack and finally came out with a piece of paper. He sat there looking at it, rubbing it between his fingers. Finally, he laid it on the seat beside him and took out his atlas, something he was thankful he had managed to salvage from the old truck. Once he knew where he was going, there was nothing left to do but get started. It was a long way, and he was not looking forward to the drive. But he wanted to get away, and he never wanted to see Land O'Lakes again. It was late, and Thad didn't expect to see anyone out, but he really didn't care either way. He made his way to I-75.
He drove until he reached the exit for Lake Panasoffkee and got off.
The exit ramp dead-ended into another road, and Thad needed to take a right. As he approached the T in the road ahead of him, Thad saw a makeshift roadblock. The area around it was dark, and as the headlights swung around to light up the area,